Tonight on KUMD, we bring you a 2018 Alworth International Lecture, Yemen, the Forgotten War, presented by former U.S. Ambassador Stephen Sesh, Executive Vice President of the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington, D.C.
Thank you all for coming out this evening. It's a pleasure to be here. My thanks to the Alworth Institute for inviting me. And thanks to all of you who were here last night. I didn't scare you away. That's remarkable. That speaks to the character of Minnesotans that you've come back for a second round. So congratulations for your endurance and your determination. What we will do tonight, I hope, is take a look at a war that too many Americans know much too little about. And there's a couple of reasons for that, and I'll try to get into those to explain why. One of which, of course, and thanks for the map up here because it can be very helpful, is geography. And if you look where Yemen sits, it is bounded here by the Gulf of Aden, the Indian Ocean, and the Red Sea. So what we don't get out of Yemen, in spite of all of the hardships, the violence, the protracted conflict, is this migration flow that we see coming out of Syria. You don't have the people who can go overland from Syria to Turkey to Greece to Europe. So that human, that human tide of misery that has captured our imagination for so long is not something we see coming out of Yemen, because you just can't get there from Yemen. So a lot of Yemenis have dispersed in the region. You know, they've come here to Djibouti. They've gone to some extent, not so much to Oman, but a lot of them have dispersed right inside of Yemen. So they're now what we call internally displaced people. And out of a country of 27 million, you probably have 2 or 3 million who have left their homes where the conflict is most pronounced, which is up around here, and they've gone out here. Because this is desert for the most part. This is what they call the Rubahali, the empty quarter. And it's pretty inhospitable, but it's also not an area where the conflict has really intruded as yet. So the Yemenis, for the most part, have not been on the map in terms of, oh my God, look at these awful pictures of human misery we see. And Syria really has been the country that's most captured our imagination in that respect. Another reason why Yemen is not really made it onto our map is the fact that economically Yemenis are poor. This is the poorest country in the Arab world. So they don't have the wherewithal, basically, to move too far in the first place. And thirdly, Saudi Arabia, which is the other real protagonist in this war, has done a very good job of bottling up the ability of international journalists to go into Yemen to see what it looks like, to capture the images, to capture the stories of the human suffering and the human dimensions of the conflict. So what we have then is a conflict which has gone on now. Well, I mean, the Saudi intervention has gone for over 3 years. We just celebrated the third anniversary on March 25th. But the conflict before that had gone on since 2014 and a little bit before that as well. We'll talk about that some more as well. So this is why Yemen has kind of slipped off the front pages of our newspapers and hasn't really made it onto our TV screens as well. A little bit more now because of the anniversary. We're getting more coverage, and that's good. And I think also our Congress in Washington has started to pay more attention, which is also good. And we'll talk a little bit about why Congress has gotten itself stirred up a little bit, and what that's had an impact on the White House as well. But the question is for all of us here this evening, why do we even care? I mean, Yemen is tucked way over here. We see it's way, way far away from us. Why does it impact our lives? Why should we be concerned about it? Well, there's a couple of good reasons why. One of which, and this is less practical than perhaps it is a value or a humanitarian issue, is just that, is the human suffering and the dimensions of the human suffering in Yemen at the moment. And maybe you've seen some of the stories, nation of 27 million people, 22 million are in immediate need of humanitarian food and medical assistance, 18.4 million are on the brink of starvation, 1 million people are suffering from cholera, the largest outbreak of cholera in modern history. You've got almost 500,000 children suffering from malnutrition. That's going to be a whole generation of Yemeni children that will never grow to their full potential because basically their brains will not develop. So you've got a blight on that country that I think demands all of us to be concerned, that demands all of us to pay attention, and insists that we all do what we can to keep this issue in the front and center of our nation's politicians. Now, there's another reason why we should be concerned. Well, there's a couple of other reasons. And very practically, in the past, we have had two attacks launched on the United States from Yemen. Because there is an offshoot of Al-Qaeda called Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is pretty well dug in here. A lot of them came from Saudi Arabia, but there's a lot of Yemenis involved. And there are not too many foreigners, because Yemen is really not that attractive a location for foreign fighters to go to. There may be some as Syria starts to close up. Some may decide to go to Yemen. I suspect a lot more will decide to go to Europe, because, it's more convenient, it's better living, and there's a lot more work to be done in terms of these extremists in Europe than in Yemen. But AQAP, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, is resident in Yemen, and it's one of the most lethal franchises. In 2009, you may recall, there was a young Nigerian man who got on a plane flying into Detroit, Michigan, and he had explosives packed into his underwear. He tried to detonate as the plane was flying over the city, and the explosives failed to detonate. I mean, really just pure chance, act of God. Nobody stopped it, nobody thwarted it. It just didn't work very well. The following year, 2010, there were a bunch of cartridges, toner cartridges, inside printers, computer printers, loaded in Yemen with a destination of a synagogue in Chicago with an intermediate stop in London on a FedEx plane. Thanks to good intelligence from the Saudis, that shipment was intercepted and offloaded, and the bombs were dismantled. So on two separate occasions, Al-Qaeda in Arabian Peninsula has tried to conduct lethal attacks on the homeland. In addition, AQAP also had a hand in attacks in Paris in 2015 of the satirical weekly Charlie Hebdo. So we know they have these ambitions. We know that AQAP wants nothing more than to be able to launch attacks on external targets, and they have. They also have in their ranks a bomb maker named Ibrahim Asiri, whose one goal in life is to manufacture a non-ferrous, non-metallic bomb, something that will not be detected or discovered when we go through airport security and when they look for metallic items in our pockets or our suitcases. This is what they're striving for, and we know their ambitions are such, it will not stop unless they are really turned off. Now, what are we doing about it at the moment? Well, not a whole lot. Basically, the Saudis have come into the war to fight the Houthi rebels who come from this corner of Yemen, have focused really in a very single-minded fashion on this war of their own between the Houthi rebels, who they claim, the Saudis claim, are supported by Iran, and Saudi Arabia, and the government of Yemen, again, because they're trying to restore that, and we'll get to that in a minute. But so the Saudis have not really taken this counterterrorism fight as the primary cause to be in Yemen. However, the United Arab Emirates, which is sitting up here, you can see the UAE, which is another partner in the Saudi coalition, has done a much different approach to this business. And so the Saudis came in March 2015 and started to launch air attacks, pretty much only air attacks over Yemen. The UAE, in April, sent special forces around here, Aden, you don't have here, but it's about here, and they launched an amphibious assault on the city of Aden. Now, they came to us at the time, in April of 2015, and said, we need your help. We want you to support this attack of ours into Aden, because that's where the Houthis had swept down all the way from the north. And we said, we don't like the plan very much. We don't think you can make it work, so why don't you just try it on your own? Well, they did. And to their credit, they did make it work. And then they got in here, they cleaned out Aden pretty well of AQAP and also the Houthis, who had marched all the way down from Sana'a. And then they came up this way, and the UAE took a sharp right with their special forces and went over here and started to fight AQAP, the terrorists. Now, we have a small contingent of our own special operators in Yemen, maybe a couple dozen, sometimes maybe there's 100. So we've kind of paired up with the UAE, and we are fighting the counterterrorism fight there, because in our judgment, that is the external threat. The Houthi rebels are not someone that we ever imagine or believe have an external target, a goal. They have their own ambitions, but they're internal to Yemen. They are not looking to expand territory or claim territory elsewhere. So therefore, the AQAP fight is something that we feel is very important to continue, given the history I just described to you. And we've helped join forces with the UAE and a lot of Yemeni forces that they've trained, what they call their security belt in Yemen, take the fight to AQAP. It's fairly episodic. It's kind of like whack-a-mole. You find a little bunch, you smack them down, they pop up elsewhere, smack them down, they pop up elsewhere again. We've also accelerated the operational tempo of our drone strikes in Yemen considerably from the Obama administration to the Trump administration in an effort to pressure on AQAP. Now, another reason why we need to care about Yemen is this little narrow neck of water right to its immediate south, right here where the D is in Djibouti. That's about 11 miles wide. It's called the Bab el-Mandeb. And through that little narrow neck passes about 4 million barrels of oil a day. This is an enormously important shipping lane. All this oil comes out of the Persian Gulf, streams around here, down past Oman, through the Gulf of Aden, and goes through here. And then goes up the Red Sea, Suez Canal, flows into Europe, North America, and elsewhere. So this is, I mean, if that were ever constricted, shut off, or disrupted, it'd be a huge economic blow to global trade. And we just saw this, overnight there was an attack by the Houthis who fired a missile at a Saudi oil tanker in this area. So, I mean, it's not beyond the realm of the possibility that you would have an attack on a commercial vessel, a large oil tank, that could basically execute that kind of disruption I'm talking about, much to the dismay of the international economy. So not a second reason why we need to worry about Yemen. And thirdly is this country right here, Saudi Arabia. As I say, the main protagonist in the war, and arguably our most important ally in the Middle East. This is the country that President Trump made his first international visit to when he became president. That was, I think, in April, or maybe I think it was in April or May of last year. To basically say to the Saudis, we are here with you, you are our close ally, we need you to be supportive of us, and we will be supportive of you. And for the Saudis, that was music to their ears, because they had had a falling out during the Obama administration, President Obama, and a very clear signal he sent to the Saudis and others that we are not going to get involved in Middle East conflicts anymore, that we've had it with that. Iraq was a mess. We shouldn't have done that. Syria is a mess. We can't fix that. And no matter how we try, we get blamed for the bad things that happen. So frankly, fellas, you're on your own to figure this out. And the Saudis decided that that's what they were going to do. The Saudis and the Emiratis in March of 2015 came to the U.S. and said, you know what, we're going to go into Yemen now. They were scared to death by what they saw at their immediate border. Here's Saudi Arabia, a country of about, well, yeah, it's about 28 million people, and Yemen sits hard right here. And the Saudis see the Houthi rebels, who again, they live, for the most part, right up through here, sweeping down here, occupying pretty much all the territory they needed to, and serving, in the Saudi view again, as the tip of the Iranian spear. So you have Iran, which is over here, now suddenly has a foothold in Yemen. You have an Iranian politician saying, oh, now you know what? Iran now controls four capitals in the Middle East. Damascus, Beirut, Baghdad, and Sana'a. And this is really getting the Saudis to be very uneasy about the future of the security of their country and the neighboring states in the region, because suddenly Iran is on the march. So they come to us and they say, we're going to do this, and they don't say, Mother, may I, because Obama has made it pretty clear he's not going to jump the raid anyway. So they say, you know, we want to go forward on this. And we say, okay, you know, this could be a mess. Why don't we become a limited partner in your coalition? Because they say we have an Arab coalition, and they do. It's a bunch of countries. Jordan's involved. The UAE is involved. Sudan is involved. And other countries. You know, Egypt sent, I think, one naval vessel. They didn't want to get too involved. And then we said, okay, but, you know, why don't we become a supporting cast member, if you will. Not an active member of the coalition, but we'll provide you with what we do right now. Aerial refueling of their jets, intelligence, support, and logistics. So we can help you with this war of yours. And we sell them a ton of weapons. And we sell them a lot of advanced munitions that are supposed to be smart. Right? These are smart bombs. These are the ones that are supposed to be able to avoid collateral damage and civilian deaths. Not so much, because frankly, the UN has estimated that for the most part, about 20% of the civilian deaths in Yemen's war are a result of Saudi Arabia's air war. So what we did was we got involved in this supporting role, which was turns out to be the worst of both worlds for us. Because we can't do enough in that role to really shape the outcome of Yemen's war, but we can certainly do just enough to be blamed every time there's an errant missile strike and the remains of that missile on the ground, say, made by Raytheon in the US of A. So we get tagged for all of the bad things, and we have not been able to really shape the war to minimize the damage to civilian life in Yemen and to bring it to a quick outcome, which was our other basic intention by jumping on board in that limited way. So March 2015, the bombing begins. I mentioned to Tom the other day, I saw there's a group called the Yemen Data Project, which tracks Saudi airstrikes. And in December of last year, they said that in that almost 3 years, Saudi Arabia had flown 15,500 sorties over Yemen. Now, Yemen is about the size of Texas. It's a little smaller than Texas. 15,500. I saw an article yesterday morning in the Christian Science Monitor, I'm sure citing the same data from the same organization. That number is now 16,500, so another 1,000 in the intervening 3 months. So the operational tempo has persisted. Saudi continues to fire, you know, the rockets, the missiles down, on ostensibly on hostile targets, but the fact of the matter is they're not that good at it, even with smart weapons. They're missing a lot of the targets. They're shooting at a lot of civilian operational sites. They claim the Houthis, you know, go in, and this is probably true to some extent. They go into schools and hospitals and set those up as headquarters. You know, and they say, well, we have to go in and get the Houthis. But it doesn't always work out that way. So, anyway, so this has been a problem for us all along, is to try to get the Saudis to get better at their game, to be better, and to use our weapons in ways that are not going to be us the same reputational risk, because we are running this reputational risk. Not just Saudi Arabia, but we are as well, because our name is attached to these bombs, as I say. And it comes back to haunt us quite frequently that we are the ones who provided these weapons to Saudi Arabia in this case. So the question becomes then, well, how did we get here in the first place? Well, without going back too far, let me go back only as far as 2011. Maybe a little bit further than that. The Houthi rebels are coming, again, as I said, from the north of Yemen. There's Zaydi Shia. Now, the Zaydi Shia are about 35% of Yemen's population. About 65% are Sunni. Now, Zaydis are different from the Iranian Shia. There's fivers, there's twelvers. Without getting into that, they've lived pretty happily in Yemen, side by side of the Sunni population, who's Shafi, for years. And the Yemenis were always very proud of the fact that they would tell you that they would worship in each other's mosques. And the only way to tell if you were Shia or Sunni would be the Sunnis fold their arms like this over the chest when they pray. Shia have their hands at their side. And you could go to any mosque and find people, Shia and Sunni, worshiping side by side. It wasn't a sectarian-tinged nation. That's changed a lot since the war began. It's got a much more sectarian edge to it now, and that is really because Saudi Arabia, being the large Sunni Arab nation it is, and it is, of course, the custodian of the two holy shrines of Islam, the Grand Mosque in Mecca and in Medina. And then Iran, which is Shia, which is Persian, which has a long, hostile relationship with the Arab world. So now with these two together bumping heads, people are painting this as a sectarian war. I still don't think it is. I still don't think that that's what really has driven these parties' conflict. But it becomes easier and easier to make this very pithy assessment of it as being a sectarian Iran versus Saudi Arabia conflict. So the Houthi rebels have come out of this this northern part of Yemen, and they were really very much neglected. That's what I mean. They were not here because they felt that it was a religious war for them. This was a very poor area. They were not taken care of by the central authority. But Yemen's central government is very, very weak. It's always been very, very weak. There's a couple of reasons. First of all, entry is really dispersed. So you don't have a lot of people who can come out to these parts and provide services. I've always said that Yemenis have very low expectations of the government, and they're never disappointed. Because the government would only be there to basically try to, you know, tax them or oppress them. They would not be there to provide the services, dig the wells, pave the streets, build the schools, or otherwise ensure that their livelihoods were being met. So you've got an issue of population dispersal, and also you have the elites very much clustered in the city. So the government tended to spend most of its time paying attention to the elites, the political elites in Sana'a and elsewhere. They would not really spend a lot of time looking out to the other parts of the country to do that, including in the north, the Houthi rebels come from. So, in 2004, the hostilities between the Houthis, who had kind of formed around this group, called themselves the Believing Youth, that wanted to bring attention to the plight of the Zaydi Shia, and the Houthis then broke out. The Houthis themselves, again, a subset of the Zaydi Shia, only 2% of the population, the Houthis. But in 2004, started to have an annual little bit of, not a war, but an armed conflict with the government of then President Ali Abdullah Saleh. Every year for 6 years, 2004, they'd have a little armed conflict. Houthis and the government of Sana'a would duke it out. No one really won. They would go back to their neutral corners and say, we'll come back and see you next year. And they did. The final one was in 2010, and that was the year Saudi Arabia actually got involved in the wars, because at that point, the Houthis claimed that the Saudis were letting the Yemeni army go up into Saudi Arabia and come back down and attack the Houthis from the north, crossing their border again. So the Saudis got involved in that because the Houthis started lobbing missiles into Saudi Arabia. The Saudis got their air force involved. They lost an airplane. This was back in 2010. And this is supposed to be the time when the Saudis are, you know, well-trained, top-line fighter jets provided by us, training for their pilots provided by us, and they get shot down by this ragtag group of guys in sandals coming out of these mountains who don't even have any heavy weapons to speak of. Well, they have some, and we'll talk about how they got them, too. So then, the Houthis in 2010, kind of moving their way down here, because they're getting very restive in the north. And what happens in 2010, 2011? The Arab Awakening. The Arab Spring strikes, and it strikes in Yemen, the same way it struck in Egypt, and it struck in Syria, and Tunisia, and the other countries, all through the Arab world during that time. So the Houthis are involved in this. I mean, they've got as much reason as anybody in Yemen to want to see Ali Abdullah Saleh doesn't go away. Again, he's tormented them for how many years now? 6 years in these wars. He's ignored them, their needs. He's impoverished them, along with most of Yemen, because frankly, Ali Abdullah Saleh and his family were there only to enrich themselves. I said to a Yemeni friend of mine one time, I said, you know, the Saleh family treats Yemen like it's a family-owned and operated operation, enterprise. And he said, you know, if it were, they'd take better care of it. So anyway, they go to Sana'a, and they act like good citizens. You know, they get on the street, they protest, they carry on, they want to see changes, they want to see an end to this corrupt elite which has basically impoverished Yemen and enriched themselves. And this goes on for a while, and chaos ensues, and then at the end of 2011, looks like Yemen's going to fall into complete civil war. Saudi Arabia comes in with the help of the other Gulf countries and a little bit from the U.S. and others, and they broker a deal. They say to Ali Abdullah Saleh, then president, okay, Mr. President Saleh, 35 years has been a long time of having to endure you. Why don't you just disappear? Well, no, he didn't want to do that, because Saleh was a man who only knew Yemen. I mean, he ate, breathed, everything he did was for Yemen. He thought he was the Yemen, and that was his mindset. So what he arranged was, he said, fine, I will step down from the presidency. This was in late 2011, November 2011. I'll step down. I'll make way for a successor. But I get to stay in Yemen, and I get to continue to participate in the political life of this country. So in retrospect, that was the fatal flaw of the deal. Because we should have known, well, we did know, that Ali Abdullah Saleh would never keep his fingers out of the pie. That as long as he was there and breathing, he would be trying to make mischief for everybody who remained. And he was. That's all he did. But on the other hand, he wouldn't have struck the deal. If we had said, no, you've got to go, he wouldn't have taken the deal. And then we'd be stuck with him even longer. So it was an imperfect deal. And besides, nobody wanted him. I mean, he just was an irritant to everybody. Nobody would take him in. No, they might have. But he was such an ornery individual. He'd angered everybody in the region. So anyway, he stayed. And he did muck about in Yemen's politics. And the deal was imperfect. Went through a long, very, very extravagant national dialogue conference organized by the United Nations, which is supposed to figure out all of these essential questions of, like, a federal Yemen. What does it look like? How do we rewrite a constitution? How do we schedule elections with the national unity government? What is this going to be? What does Yemen in the future look like that's going to be fair, responsible, with new leadership that's going to really take us in the 21st century? It didn't work. The National Dialogue Conference dragged on for an extra 3 months, still couldn't find a resolution to it. And slowly, this whole thing started to collapse. Meanwhile, the Houthis, seeing this, I mean, they were still being pretty good citizens in terms of their participation in this whole political process. But this is how people see them, and I don't really dispute this. There is a bit of Hezbollah. If you know Hezbollah, the armed militia in Lebanon, they have a political wing and a military wing. Well, that's a model, to some extent, the Houthis have emulated. They have a political wing, which was there at the National Dialogue Conference, talking about the changes, the constitutional issues, and you had an armed wing, which was slowly working its way down. And in 2014, they basically rushed into Sana'a, into the capital, and seized the reins of government. It was pretty easy, largely because nobody was ready for this. No one really thought that they would go all the way into the Capitol and actually try to take over. Well, they didn't want to take over the government because nobody really wants to run Yemen. It's just a bit of an unmanageable entity. But they did create a shadow government. They would send their fighters into the ministries, let all the bureaucrats stay there, but they would oversee payments, disbursements, other things that they had to take care of to make sure they were getting their share of the money. So in September 2014, President Hadi, who was the successor to Ali Abdullah Saleh, he had been vice president for 33 years and was elevated to this role, which is another reason why Saleh was so bitter. I mean, Saleh was vindictive because he saw that he was betrayed by his vice president of 33 years, who fully stepped in to become president, by the Saudis, who should have done better by him because he was the champion of Yemen and had united Yemen in 1990. So Saleh wanted nothing more than to get back at all of these folks who put knives in his back in 2000. So what does he do? He jumps into bed with the Houthis. One of the oddest marriages in modern history. Years of oppression and neglect. Saleh says, let's make a deal and we'll be allies. So the Houthis say, sure, why not? You've got all of these arms. You've got an army. You can help us. And Saleh says, you're right. And so the Houthis, they march all the way down to Aden. So they control this entire swath of Yemen. And out here, there's really nothing to worry about. Again, this is desert, so nobody cares. This is when the alarm bells go off in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere. Oh my God, the Houthis are everywhere. And that means Iran's right behind them. That means we've lost Yemen. They're going to come for us across the southern border. That's March 2015 when the Saudi war begins. Now, I apologize for those who were here last night. In March 2015, the Saudis say, we're going to go into Yemen. We have three objectives. Okay? The first one is to protect our national territory, because we're getting all this border incursions. These Houthi fighters keep coming across the border into Saudi Arabia. And there's cities. There's three or four cities. There's Hamas Mushayt and Jizan, Najran in southern Saudi Arabia. And the Houthis are going across the border at will. So they want to stop that. And they also want to make sure the Houthis don't get ballistic missiles and fire them across the border into their national territory. 3 years later, they failed miserably at achieving this goal. The Houthis fundamentally now have a permanent presence inside southern Saudi Arabia. They come and go at will, with impunity. And the Saudis can't seem to stop them. And ballistic missiles, they've been firing ballistic missiles further and further into Saudi Arabia, thanks to Iran, which has now been importing and smuggling missile parts and enhancements for some of the scuds that were in the Yemeni arsenal to extend their range. The original scuds that Yemenis had as part of their arsenal had about a 300-kilometer range. Now with this, what they call a baby bottle nose cone, it extends it to 500 kilometers. And they've been able to reach all the way up to the outskirts of Riyadh, the capital, which is quite alarming. In November, they fired a missile from Yemen that landed very close to the King Khalid International Airport in Riyadh, which is pretty alarming, because what if it actually hit the airport? What if it actually hit Riyadh? You can imagine the consequences of a Houthi missile strike on a large population center. This whole war would metastasize in ways we can't even imagine. So the Saudis were alarmed about it then. It's getting worse and worse in the 3 years that it intervened. Now, the second goal was to restore the legitimate government of President Hadi, who was in exile in Riyadh because he was chased out by the Houthis. He went up to Riyadh, and he's living pretty well. Went to visit him in July of last year, and he's up there, isolated. He's happy. But he can't get back into Yemen. I mean, basically, he's public enemy number one in Yemen. Do you know why? Because he was the one who told the Houthis back in March 2015, yeah, go in here and chase those Houthis out. Start that bombing run, would you please? And the Yemenis can't understand why their own president sicked Saudi Arabia on their country and has basically pummeled it for the last 3 years. So Hadi's still up there. They failed on that count. And thirdly, the other goal was to keep Iran out of Yemen. Well, clearly Iran has come into Yemen with both feet. And a lot of that was at the invitation of Saudi Arabia. And when Saudi Arabia went into March 2015, Iran said, okay, fine, you want to play that way? We'll give them a little bit more, too. And Iran has been there for a long time. Iran's presence in Yemen goes back, you know, to shortly after the revolution in 79, when the theocracy came in. The Ayatollah came in, the religious leadership, they have what they call it Wilayat al-Faqih, which is basically leadership by religious elite. And they would come in, and they would invite not just Yemenis, but Shia from everywhere in the region, throw in Iran, and they would study, they would get scholarships, they'd spend time. There wasn't even a Houthi movement, but there were the Zaydis, and so they were cultivating relationships back as far as the 1980s. Some of the Houthis probably went themselves. So Iran's been there for a long time, but it was not a military presence until far more recently when the Houthis became an armed presence, and the Iranians saw a reason to get more deeply involved, which is fundamentally to unnerve Saudi Arabia. You know, poke a little stick at the bear, you know, and say, hey, you know, we are here. You know, guess what? We're not just over here in Lebanon. We're not just here in Bahrain, but we're also now in Yemen. We're also in Iraq. So these, you know, this theory of the four capitals is something that the Iranians, I don't think it's true necessarily, but the Iranians love to spin this because it makes the Saudis so nervous. Can't believe that they're losing all the territory, their nemesis. So here we have the three goals unmet 3 years later. The war goes on. The U.S. is still involved. Again, we're running the reputational risk by putting in munitions. Now we're starting to say to ourselves, you know, this is not going very well, and what can we do? I don't think that the Trump administration, until recently, really saw this as something we need to get involved in. I think the White House fundamentally saw this as a way to outsource successfully our two principal goals in the region to willing partners. The two goals, push back against Iran, push back against al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, counterterrorism and anti-Iran. Because, I mean, Trump's fundamental policy in the Middle East has been one of disengagement, at least militarily, much like Obama's was. And one big difference is that Trump has been very much pushing back against Iran. Right? He's trying to get, again, he's threatening to walk away from the nuclear arrangement, and he's demonizing Iran as an unreliable, antagonistic, venturistic, theocratic state, which really has a revolutionary goal in the region that we need to tamp down. But since Congress has gotten much more interested in seeing this war perhaps starting to wind down, the White House has gotten more interested as well. And we just recently had a vote in Congress that would have forced the U.S. to withdraw its military support. You know what I discussed earlier, the refueling, logistics, the intelligence, to withdraw that from the Saudi coalition because it is not authorized by what was went into effect in September 2001, the authorization for the use of military force, which that the president can deploy U.S. forces against any organization connected to al-Qaeda, which was responsible for the attacks on the U.S. on September 11th. Congress says, well, the Houthis are not that group. That's not al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda's down in the south, and you're doing nothing about them. So we have no reason to be with the Saudis. Well, that vote, I mean, they got 44 votes in support of that in the U.S. Senate. 55 voted against it. And that kind of sends a warning shot across the bow of the administration. You know, this patience will not go on forever with the way we're deploying our forces and support it. So I think the Trump administration is beginning to see this as a losing bet. On the other hand, we don't want to get sideways with the Saudis. So we're still going to continue with this. But I also was encouraged recently when the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman called on the Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis, and Secretary Mattis made some very forward-leaning comments about the fact we need to get a political solution. We're going to do something here that's going to be good for the Yemeni people. It's not a military way out. It's going to be a negotiated way out. So if Secretary Mattis is beginning to see this as the only real solution, then I think that will have some sway when they go into the White House for these cabinet meetings. And Jim Mattis says, you know, we do not want to continue with this military-only strategy of ours. We need to figure out another way in this war. So one way that I think we can start to look at this ending now is the fact there is a brand new UN envoy appointed for Yemen named Martin Griffiths, a British guy who ran some conflict resolution organization in Geneva. He's been in the region. He's been to Riyadh. He's been into Yemen. He's now going to Oman. He's trying to figure out a way to get the parties back to the table. This may be a moment when people get a little bit fatigued by this war after 3 years and decide, yes, we really should find a way to negotiate our way out of this, because it will not end militarily. There is no military solution to the war in Yemen. But it's going to take the U.S. leadership in that case to really begin to make this happen. And so I do hope that we can work closely with Saudi Arabia and the UAE and the UN And the Omanis, who can be very helpful, because the Omanis have had a very interesting foreign policy. Way over here, as close as they are to Iran, much like their neighbors, they've been a very neutral force. And they also have been, they've allowed the Houthis to have their negotiating team go to Muscat, the capital, for years, and they've helped the Houthis learn how to do negotiations. Because the Houthis, again, they're fighters. All they've done since 2004, what's this now, 14 years, is fight. They've got a whole generation of kids who've grown up with an AK-47 in their hands and just fighting year after year. They don't negotiate. They don't care about negotiating. All they want to do is... But the Houthis, again, they have a political leadership that knows in their own hearts that they can't win. I mean, they can't lose it. It's almost hard. You know, the Houthis win just by not losing. The Saudis have achieved a victory. The Houthis live there. Even at, in the best of times, the best of solutions, if this war ends tomorrow, all the Houthis go back up here. And they've got to live side by side with Saudi Arabia. So the Saudis know this. The Houthis know this. And I think they know they've got to find a way to come to some terms to allow them to live that close to each other moving into the future and not be at odds with each other interminably. So this is 3 years into the war. It's been very contained. But there's no guarantee it will remain that way. And as I say, the overnight news of a Houthi missile attacking a Saudi oil tanker demonstrates to me the likelihood of a catastrophic miscalculation enlarging this war into something that really then invites more and more international players into it, much to the detriment and the instability of a region that's already convulsed by too many conflicts. So I think now is the urgent need that we face to bring this war to a close. And I just hope the White House will take the opportunity of this moment to do so. And with that, I will stop and hope you have some questions. Very much. Yes, please, sir. Ah, good question. I always thought this was one of God's dirty tricks. Yemen sits right here, just below the world's largest oil deposits, and they have a diminishing supply of oil. And they probably will not even be able to export oil, I'd say probably into 2025, that'd be the end of it. They do have liquid natural gas, and Total, the French oil energy giant, did a remarkable investment. I mean, the Europeans, like Total, they'll go into these crazy conflict-riddled zones and still do a huge pipeline that runs through tribal territory that's always being riddled with bullets, because then the tribals, the Total, say, you know what, your pipeline's right over there. You need us to guard it for you. You know, and then and I got 600 fighters who'd be happy to do that for you. So why don't you just put us on your salary? So Total has to negotiate with the same guys who just riddled their pipeline with bullet holes to become the bodyguards of the pipeline, and make sure they. And then another tribe tries to do it again. So liquid natural gas, though, I give Total credit. They've actually had an export terminal over here, and they do ship. Well, they were shipping it. They stopped now, but they were shipping oil all the way to Houston and to Boston. Until the mayor of Boston one time got wind of the fact there was a Yemeni, there was a tanker coming in that had originated in Yemen with LNG and said, not in Boston Harbor, thank you very much. Houston, meanwhile, said, that's okay, we'll take it. We have offshore terminals. There's no problem for us. But, oil is a diminishing resource. LNG is really something that maybe they can make some money with if they can get back stable again. Yes, please. Rosemary.
Thank you.
I agree with you, and you know the one roadblock to that very sensible alternative, which is basically say, why don't you go elsewhere and live happily ever after, is that there's a UN Security Council resolution called 2216, which sets out the terms for ending the war in Yemen in very stark terms. Basically, it asks the Houthis to capitulate, surrender all of their heavy weapons, give up all the territory they've seized and return to the northern border. And it also says it calls for the return, almost by name, of the legitimate authority of President Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi. So, you know, he is enshrined in the Security Council resolution as one of the terms, his return is one of the terms to end the war. Now, that suggests to me you throw that Security Council resolution out the window and say, can we renegotiate something more sensible that will allow for a transition? So Hadi maybe comes back as a transitional figure. He names a prime minister. The prime minister calls for elections, and it goes on from there without Hadi in the middle of this. Because Hadi has been a roadblock. Much like anybody else who gets the position of that power, he decides he earned it and doesn't want to give it up. So he is an obstacle. We do need to push him aside. The Saudis have been remarkably tolerant of his obstructionism, and I think it's really something that needs to end. But again, the Security Council resolution is a big obstacle to what would be a very sensible proposal, which is go to Italy. Anywhere. Yes, sir.
Would you talk about the history of Yemen, how it got born, how long it's been a country, where the region?
How much time do you have? I'll tell you an interesting thing about Yemen. Yemen, for a long time, this whole swath was ruled by the Zaydi. It was an imamate. They had an imam, a Shia theocratic state, basically here. For 1,000 years, it was ruled as an imamate. In the 1960s, Egypt supported some people in Yemen who decided they were tired of being ruled underneath this theocratic state, and they wanted a republic. So Egypt came in about 64, 65 to support the Republicans. And in a great irony, the Saudis at that time, terribly worried about the sound of the word republic when they're a monarchy and they don't sit comfortably very well together, Saudi threw its lot in with the Zaydi Shia, who they now are fighting. Protect the fact that they wanted to have a monarchy close to their own monarchy, and they wouldn't have to worry about Republicans and democracy setting an example that their population might want to emulate. So at that time then, this is kind of the reason why the Zaydi Shia began this sense of grievance, because they were basically, they were pushed aside. They lost that war. The Saudis and the Zaydi Shia lost that war. The Republic was established, and it grew into something that was a very imperfect democracy, no doubt about it. The Saudis were always very nervous about the fact that there's these poor little Yemenis down there, and they're actually getting out and they're looking like they want to cast votes. And that was something that unnerves the Saudis for a long time. So it slowly emerged as a Republic of Yemen. Then they had the Democratic People's Republic in the south, the PDRY, which was a socialist state, which the Russians had a lot of influence in. That was a British colony for a long time, because the British, of course, they like to have the sea lanes. So the British left there also early 70s. And then that became basically the reason for a civil war, which led to the unification of Yemen in 1990. And then you had one unified Yemen that emerged in 1990. It was a war after that to basically cement the results of that initial civil war in 1990. And then the unified Yemen emerged. Now, will a unified Yemen emerge after this war? It's really hard to see that that's a possibility. It's hard to see, and it's always been very fractured, because you can't see the relief map here. But these are highlands, and they're pretty productive in terms of agriculture and resources. Of course, down here you get a lot of fisheries, and you get a lot of energy, a lot of oil down here, what they tend to have it, and natural gas. And down here you have nothing. The Saudis will tell you to me now, oh, you know what, the war's going well. We control 80% of Yemen. And I said, what 80% do you control exactly? You know what it is? It's right out here. And I said, who cares? You know, that's 20% of the population. And the Houthis control 20% of the territory, but 80% of the population, because they control Sana'a and the highlands. So they flipped it. So the Saudis are putting this very happy face on this, you know, how much territory they control, but they don't control the population. Now, the Houthis do, but they do it at the point of a gun. I'm not here to say the Houthis are in any way, you know, something we want to consider to be a force to support. They started the war. They executed a coup d'etat against an internationally recognized government at the point of a gun. The Saudis had every good reason to go into Yemen. In principle, it was something that the international community should have done. We shouldn't allow that kind of behavior to take place. So the principle of intervention in Yemen is not a problem. It is basically the execution of the plan that's been so pitiful. And that's why the war has gone on for this long. Yes, sir.
Because you don't see a military solution, who do you realistically think could help broker any sort of peace in the region? Because our presence obviously physical out there.
Yeah. Well, you're going to have to, you know, they've got to open a pretty big tent here, I think. And you've got to be able to say Iran has got to have a role in this. And the Iranians can influence the Houthis. They don't control the Houthis, and they didn't engineer this revolt either. You know, they are happy to take advantage of it, and they're happy to exploit it for their own ends. They do have a relationship that they can use. They can whisper in the Houthis' ear, "Don't you think it's time to wrap this up?" And I think the Houthis would probably listen to them. So you want to get the Iranians involved. The Russians could get involved in this. They'd be willing to be helpful because they've had, again, thanks to the whole Socialist Republic, they've had a very long history. Putin would love nothing more than to get back into Aden Harbor and bring his naval vessels around for port calls again to demonstrate Imperial Russia has returned. The U.S. needs to be involved because I think it's very important for Saudi Arabia for them to know that we're going to be at the table to help support them. You also have now, you have a very kind of resurgent secessionist movement in the south of Yemen. And they were excluded from the early negotiations because nobody wanted to talk about secession. You know, everybody was so hard over on a unified Yemen that bringing secessionists or separatists to the table suggested you were endorsing the idea of a division of Yemen all over again. And that was anathema. I do think you need to bring the separatists back to the table now. They have a lot of clout, and the Emiratis have spent a long time down here doing nothing except encouraging them. And you might ask, why are they, if they're the Saudis' best ally, why are they encouraging a separatist movement? Because I think the Emiratis are ambitious, and they see this as a future way for them to control natural resources and to deploy forces very effectively. I talked about it last night, all through the region so they can forward deploy and have a way to be able to effectively blunt any attacks on their homeland. So it's hard to see, and who does the brokering? I think the UN is going to be the organization that convenes whatever happens. They still have that convening power. But we need to say, yes, this is a very good idea, and we're going to throw our weight diplomatically and politically behind it, and we have not been willing to do so yet. Yes, sir.
You're here, and in many ways, part of your project is to make sense of the situation for us. And so it ends up being a matter of experience and your attempt to validate, and yet your whole kind of like a life experience and period of time when the United States government has a certain amount of stability of policy from the administration. But it really does look as though the United States has come to a point that that's broken down in the partnership of our own government, and that anything that the last government, the last administration, the promise. This administration feels they're free to abandon and say that was always a horrible bad. And there ends up being some part where you would end up having some sense that the next administration would end up being able to look, say, we are the other side. But who out there could end up meeting that they would have anything more than like 4 years in the next. So as you look and put together, you end up talking about roles that imply, like the U.S. being involved in truthfully helping solve things here. Is that really any type of realistic prospect for the United States going forward, given our government?
Well, you know, I'll tell you, I'm an optimist. Okay, I think I always thought to go into diplomacy, you had to be an optimist because you had to believe you can really resolve conflict without going to war. So I do believe that we can do this. I don't believe it's going to be the president himself who stands tall in the middle of this mess and says, "I'm going to instruct my people." But I don't think he will impede efforts to bring this sort of a close, because I think people will be able to counsel him that it's in our interest, in his interest, not to be seen participating in this ongoing protracted war which has created this huge humanitarian nightmare for millions of people at some risk to us, because it really does. If we want to try to keep the Saudis and others, you know, the Jordanians in the region on our side, we've got to be able to prove ourselves to be a reliable ally. So we can't be quite as fickle in our relationships with them. That would suggest a complete flip from what we have been known as, which is a guarantor of security in that region. That was always our role to play. I don't think he wants to walk away from that, and even if he does, I think people like Jim Mattis and others will argue strongly we have to do this because it's important for us not to have these pockets of instability that will create more extremism you know, and just really, you know, create more risk. That's why I think our interest, when I say Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is something that is a genuine risk to us, if you don't stop this war, they're going to metastasize further. So it's not like it's, I'm doing it because I'm a big-hearted guy. I'm doing it because I don't want to have attack on American soil originating from Yemen. So the best way to do that is to end the war, stabilize the country, and go after HIP to eliminate that threat. That's a very practical reason why I would argue with the president, you've got to stay involved in this. Not because it's for the benefit of humanity, or not because, you know, you're going to get a Nobel Prize for it, but because basically if you don't do it, we're at risk at home. And that's the only practical argument I can make. And I think it should work. Well, except the fact is that the Shia in Lebanon are much stronger than they were in Yemen, population-wise. And, you know, you don't have the whole, you know, the Shia population in Yemen in revolt. You have a very small subset of the Shia, only the Houthis, you know, this little rebellious group. So, but you're right. I mean, but the Shia also have now developed an enormous political clout. I mean, they basically, they're in parliament. They have both military and political influence, and they are part and parcel of the political system in Lebanon. The Houthis would like to be that. They've got to agree to that. I mean, in fact, I would be happy to see the Houthis say, yes, we want to become part of the political process the way Hezbollah has in Lebanon. You know, they may not be as toxic to Yemen because they're a smaller percentage. They can't control as many parliamentary seats. But that's what I think. If they're looking around and saying, can we be more like Lebanon? Yes, please do. You know, become part of this process. Don't do it at the point of gun. Do it else, and you know, do it in other ways, and run the way that Hezbollah have. They've been elected legitimately in Lebanon. But they do have larger numbers, larger influence, and Iran has also been very generous with Hezbollah in Lebanon to help them elevate their game. The point may have that kind of influence, and Iran has done the same thing to a lesser extent because it's a smaller prize. I mean, again, nobody wants to run Yemen. Yemen is not the prize. Yemen is the platform. You know, everybody's using Yemen to bounce somewhere else, into Saudi Arabia to bring down the House of Saud, into Europe to attack Western interests, into the U.S. to attack the great Satan. Yemen is just a platform to get over here and find your enemies and attack them. And I'm going to get another question from somebody else, and then we'll come back to you. Yes. Yemen is about 27 million people. And yes, the Queen of Sheba historically is said to be from Yemen. There's a Queen of Sheba site, archaeological site, probably about there, which an American archaeologist has been working on for 30 years. It's still not restored. Also, Yemen is arguably the birthplace of coffee, because there's a small port here called Mocha, M-O-C-H-A, much like the coffee, Mocha. Now, the Ethiopians argue the point. They say, no, we originated coffee. I think Yemen has a very good case. In fact, there's a new book out by Dave Eggers, and it's called, it has Mocha in the title. Not the mayor of Mocha, but it's something. Anyway, if you're interested in Mocha in its history, I understand the book is fascinating. Dave Eggers is a very interesting writer. In terms of Christians from Syria, I think Christians are getting the same bum rap as any other Syrian at the moment. I don't think we've been able to discriminate in a positive sense at all between the most put upon, the most oppressed, the most repressed, the most oppressed populations. We basically say Syrians, Arabs, Middle Easterners, I'm in the queue somewhere, you know, and we've really slow rolled our immigration policy. And we're not doing very, and we're not doing well with people who worked for us in Iraq. We have all these translators, guys who put their lives on the line, associated themselves with our government. And we're having a hard time getting them to come in to emigrate. So again, our immigration policy is a work in progress. And in my mind, it's got to find a way to be able to be a little more generous with those who deserve the protections and deserve the rewards of having worked for us or not. But we can't leave, you know, in this vulnerable state, especially with extremists who like nothing more than targeting Christian communities in the Middle East at the moment. I mean, again, the reason why it's not the crisis is because it's so undeveloped and the poverty is so deeply rooted in Yemen right now. It would take a lot of investment. I mean, a serious amount of years and investment in dollar terms to bring this into any kind of economic productivity. Now, one thing Yemen does have potentially is a very lucrative fisheries industry. Yeah, and the problem is, you know, like, you don't want to ever be in a natural resource game. You don't want to be on the ground floor. You don't want to be the ones who produce the natural resource and export the natural resource to somebody who does the packaging, the processing, and the exporting. And that's what Yemen does now. They catch the fish, and they sell them to the UAE or Saudi Arabia, and the Saudis and the Emiratis do the processing and the packaging and the exporting, and they make the money. Not the fishermen in Yemen. So you, again, in the export of natural resources, get on the high end of it, where the export is really being managed by you, not where the, you're taking it out of the ground or out of the ocean, because that's not where the money is. Sure. Yeah, they're a little bit like the Alawites in some ways. They're a little bit of a weird offshoot of Shiism. Yeah, I don't think it can be. The Yemenis have got to some kind of come to a compact among themselves. They will see, again, we'll see this as a Yemeni solution. If it looks like it's being imposed by us or the Saudis, it won't be legitimate, and it's not going to last. So I agree with you fully.
You just heard from former U.S. Ambassador Stephen Sesh. You can find this lecture in its entirety at kumd.org. Tonight's Alworth Lecture was brought to you by the Alworth Institute for International Students at UMD and by KUMD Duluth Public Radio. This episode was produced by Brianna Kaiser, Andrew Ressler, Brianna Menzimer, Slade Gulan, Maya Jensen, and Cindy Christian.